Welcome to History Class After Hours. I'm Joseph Barra, and returning is Eli.
Good morning.
Eli's back.
Yeah.
Woo. All right.
Let's do this.
So today we are going to continue talking about Pearl Harbor to commemorate the 80th anniversary of the attack. That was on December 7th. Last week we talked about kind of all the events that were leading up to the attack and just how the relationships between the United States and Japan started to become more and more strained. Primarily, it was over economic competition in East and Southeast Asia. The Japanese then invaded China, and the United States was like, don't invade China. And the two were fighting over that. And then, so because Japan invaded China, the United States stopped giving Japan valuable war materials like oil, iron, things like that. So Japan was like, can't get it from you, we gotta get it from somewhere else. So they started becoming more aggressive in Southeast and East Asia, and eventually it culminated with the Japanese government deciding to launch an attack on the United States Pacific Fleet. And by November of 1941, late November, early December, they were on their way. All right. So the Japanese objectives were they were hoping an attack would achieve several things. First, they hoped to destroy the American fleet so it could not intervene in Japanese action in Southeast Asia. So the Japanese had already, to coincide with the attack on Pearl Harbor, they were also going to attack Southeast Asia as well. So like Singapore, Malaysia, because they needed the natural resources.
Right.
And they felt that if they attacked Southeast Asia, the United States would declare war on them because of that.
Right.
So they were preemptively hitting the United States, believing that if they did went ahead with the attacks in Southeast Asia, the United States is already going to declare war on them, so we might as well hit them before they declare
first,
war.
And then
yes.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
When in reality, if you read a lot of the documentation from the U.S. government, we didn't really care about Southeast Asia.
We probably wouldn't have done anything.
Yep, because we were
neutrals.
Neutral, isolationist. Second, they hoped to use the time it took the Americans to rebuild to build a defensive perimeter. So most in the Japanese military didn't believe they could fight a long war with the United States. They were thinking maybe 2-3 years at the max. So they were hoping that they could destroy the U.S. Navy and at that time build basically a defensive perimeter around their gains and then fight a war of attrition, hoping to outlast the United States. They also wanted to destroy the U.S. ability to wage war in the Pacific by targeting primarily the battleships and aircraft carriers. And also they were hoping that they could destroy American morale with one decisive defeat to the point where the United States would seek peace with Japan and given Japanese demands. All right. There was many in the Japanese government, many in the Japanese military that thought that because the United States wasn't really doing anything as the world was erupting in war, that was a weak position to take and that the United States was unwilling to fight. On the other hand, you had a lot of people in the Japanese military who had studied in the United States and kind of knew about the resolve of the American people.
Yeah.
And they were like, this may not be the best idea. So the Japanese fleet, sorry about that. Might need to edit that one out.
Don't know how to do that.
Mr. Barra's choking to death here. Yeah. So the Japanese fleet was to approach the Hawaiian Islands from the north. And as they left Japan, they went on radio silence. So they weren't even communicating with each other via radio. The only way they were communicating with each other were through signals and things like that. So the plan called for 360 planes to be launched in two waves to attack military targets on Oahu. That's where Pearl Harbor is. The first wave would consist of planes armed with torpedoes. Remember, they had designed special torpedoes so they could... Pearl Harbor is relatively shallow, so a normal torpedo would like hit the bottom and just stop. So they put wood fins on the back of them to make them more buoyant, so they would more skid. And also dive bombers.
Right.
They were told to select the highest value targets, which were the battleships and aircraft carriers. Other dive bombers were to attack ground targets, while fighters were to strafe airfields. There was a Japanese spy, his name was Takeo Yoshikawa, and he had given the Japanese detailed information of the harbor. So much so that Japanese pilots actually knew what our ships, individual ships, looked like, and so they knew exactly what they were going after when they were attacking the harbor. There was also going to be 5 midget subs, all right, that were going to be launched, and they were supposed to get inside the harbor and attack at the same time as the planes. Midget subs had a crew of 2 and were armed with 2 torpedoes.
So they were ready to, like, put little submarines in the harbor with them.
Yes.
Too. That's.
And the midget subs were actually attached to normal subs, and then the normal subs went off the coast of Hawaii and just dropped them off. So the original plan also called for the Japanese to declare war on the United States about 30 minutes before the attack commenced. Japanese ambassador was supposed to deliver a message to the U.S. government that negotiations between the two countries were over. The attack was supposed to commence, like I said, 30 minutes after the message was delivered. However, the 5,000-word statement, which was sent in code, took way too long to translate in the Japanese embassy, and they couldn't get the message delivered.
That is the most, like... Code, I know code's important, especially in, you know, when you're planning on sneak attacking the American naval operations. But if your plan is to declare war before, either make your code a little easier for the guy to encode, or, you know, don't send it in code because it's the Japanese embassy.
Or maybe give him some leeway to actually, like, write a message and just say, please write
maybe
a
don't
letter.
Give it, yeah, like, maybe don't give it an hour before. That's actually due 30 minutes before they actually do this.
Maybe the code station was run by a high schooler. Like, probably. Last minute.
That feels.
So the U.S. had actually broken Japanese code at that point and knew the message hours before it was even delivered. So basically our code breakers... We had an idea that the Japanese were planning something. We had about 80% of it broken, but we didn't have enough of it broken to know where they were planning something.
And that just shows the strength of American intelligence too, because we broke their code, you know, fairly relative into the war, and they struggled to break ours.
Yes,
because, like, I think about Midway, you know, they thought they had it, and, you know, we were just dropping.
Well, the other issue is they never changed it.
Ooh.
They kept it the same throughout the entire war, where we were constantly changing things up.
Yeah.
The message did not contain a formal declaration of war, but stated, thus the earnest hope of the Japanese government to adjust Japanese-American relations and to preserve and promote the peace of the Pacific through cooperation with the American government has finally been lost. The Japanese government regrets to have to notify hereby the American government that in view of the attitude of the American government, it cannot but consider that it is impossible to reach an agreement through further negotiations. So what happens is the attack has already happened. The U.S. government official who is meeting with the Japanese ambassador knows that the attack has already happened, and then he gets the letter. And imagine that awkwardness.
Everything's out of order now.
Yeah, everything.
Imagine the awkwardness of sitting down, the ambassador like, I have a letter, and the guy is like, we were just attacked.
Yes, like, we know what this is. So there's going to be a lot of missed warnings. U.S. intelligence and a whole bunch of other organizations are going to take a lot of heat for these missed warnings. There was plenty of opportunities to kind of figure out that, like, this was going to happen, but just...
We just didn't
act on things. So on the morning of December 7th, there were several missed opportunities by the United States to thwart the attack. The U.S. had been close to breaking Japanese code prior to the attack, as we were just talking about. U.S. codebreakers had been intercepting messages showing that the Japanese were planning something. However, they did not have enough of the code broken to know where the attack was going to take place. Warnings were given to Pearl Harbor. As a result, planes are going to be parked wingtip to wingtip to prevent sabotage. Radar stations are going to be set up, even though no one really knew how to use the new technology. Because remember, radar is brand new. The British had invented it, and they gave it over to us, and we have, like, no clue how to use it. Most also didn't believe that Pearl Harbor was a viable target just because of the distance.
It's too far.
Yeah, they were thinking more of the Philippines is what's going to get hit. So men were allowed to go on leave. Torpedo nets were not deployed, and ammunition was locked away in the magazines.
But we have torpedo nets.
Yes.
Is that underwater nets, though, when you raise them up, you know, it protects your ships from the, like, in the harbor.
Yeah, like, the torpedo gets stuck in the net.
Oh, that's actually a really
cool idea. You put it around the ship.
That's a pretty cool idea, actually.
Other events happened that could have destroyed the Japanese element of surprise. One of the midget submarines was spotted 4 hours before the attack. A U.S. destroyer would sink it, and 2 hours later, send a message to naval headquarters about the incident. By the time the message was confirmed and delivered, the attack was on its way. So you see, you're seeing, though, there's a big lack of communication going on.
Why did it take 2 hours to send that message?
It was just, I think they, if I'm not, I think they delivered it like Western Union.
What?
It was, yeah, it was something weird. There were, yeah, I think that message was like delivered like via Western Union. So you literally had like a kid on a bicycle like delivering like a, yeah, it was something weird or something like that. They actually found the mini sub a couple years ago, and they confirmed that, yeah, it was a mini sub, because they found the mini sub, and then in the conning tower, there was about a 5-inch hole from a 5-inch gun.
Gotcha. I mean, that's crazy that, you know, they're so off, like, track that there was a mini sub, you know, 4 hours early.
U.S. radar also picked up the Japanese aircraft off the coast of Oahu. The flight, though, was reported, but was shrugged off as a flight of B-17s that were coming in from San Diego. So that is just luck on the Japanese part that we have a bunch of bombers coming in from San Diego right around the same flight
pattern.
And so the guy reports it to his officer, and he's like, oh, these are just American planes. And the guy's actually like, I've never seen this many American planes coming here before.
That's, I mean, if it's two ways, you said like, what, 300 planes total? Mm-hmm. That's... Let's say that they split them up even. That's how at least 150 planes. I don't think we're flying in that many B-17s from
and
San Diego.
The other issue is that the B-17s were told to go on radio silence for security reasons. What? So they weren't able to talk with anybody. Like, hey, is that you? No. I just saw a cool video yesterday that the radar guy that actually reported it and found it, he's still alive.
Oh.
And he actually still has the handwritten note that he wrote. It's laminated.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool, actually.
Even the report that negotiations between the Japanese and U.S. were over was delayed in reaching Pearl Harbor.
So they also didn't know.
Yes. That's... So Kimmel, who was the admiral in charge, would finally get the message once the attack begun. So basically, the attack happens, and then Kimmel is getting all this information that's been going on in the morning. So the first wave of the Japanese attack would begin at about 7:48 Hawaiian time. Attack's going to be broken up into three groups. First group had 49 dive bombers, which were called Kates, and they were armed with armor-piercing bombs. And there was also 40 torpedo bombers called Vals, and they would target battleships and aircraft carriers. Also, with their modifications to their torpedoes, the bombs that the dive bombers were using were actually battleship projectiles that they put fins on, so they could be armor-piercing.
So that's not a change in, like... Because, you know, like armor piercing, like rounds out of a gun, you know, it's a different kind of metal. It's, but these were actually just, you know, regular torpedoes with fins.
Yes.
That's a really different definition of.
Second group was to target the airfields, which consisted of 51 more dive bombers. And the third group, which was made up of 43 Zeros, which were their fighters, were to target aircraft in the air and the ground. So the Japanese planes reached Oahu in two waves. The slow and vulnerable torpedo bombers led the first wave, exploiting the first moments of surprise to attack the most important ships present, the battleships. What you're going to see is the U.S. aircraft carriers are not at Pearl Harbor that day, and that's the primary target.
I know one of them was at, hang on, we talked about this in military history. One of them was, wasn't it in San Diego?
They were both sent off earlier in the week to go deliver planes to Midway and another island.
Gotcha.
And they were on their way back, and one of them was supposed to be back on December 6th, but bad weather delayed it.
Gotcha. So all I guess it's later than that. It was the Yorktown, but that's later.
Mm-hmm.
And then.
So dive bombers attacked U.S. air bases across Oahu, starting with Hickam Field, the largest, then Wheeler Field. The main U.S. Army Air Force fighter base. Of the 49 bombs that were dropped against the battleships, 8 would hit their targets. 13 of the 40 torpedoes launched would find their target. Men aboard U.S. ships awoke to the sounds of alarms, bombs exploding, and gunfire, prompting blurry-eyed men to dress as they ran to general quarters. there was a famous message being blared over the loudspeakers, air raid Pearl Harbor, this is not a drill. Because what was going on is the attack happened on a Sunday morning, and the military is just like a normal job where you get your weekends off.
Right.
So you had a bunch of 18 to 22-year-old males who had been out partying all night before, and they were sleeping in. So, yeah, completely unprepared. Some would even curse at the Army for conducting bombing raids so early in the morning. Like, nobody knows that it's a Japanese attack, even as the attack is happening. During the first attack, very few of the American defenses actually fired back. None of the Navy's 5-inch anti-aircraft guns fired back. Only about a quarter of its machine guns did. Only four of the Army's 31 anti-aircraft batteries returned fire. You even have the chaplain of the USS New Orleans, which is a heavy cruiser. He will famously say, "Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition." Because none of the all the ammunition is where?
It's locked up.
It's locked up.
It's a Sunday. You mm-hmm. don't leave.
And you're in a time of peace.
Yeah, you don't leave ammunition out, yeah. Especially with the drugs.
The second wave, consisting of 171 planes, continued the attack. Primary targets there were airfields around the islands and smaller vessels. 90 minutes after the attack had started, it was over, and the U.S. would find itself entered in World War II. U.S. casualties were staggering. 2,008 sailors were killed. Another 710 were wounded. 218 members of the Army were killed, another 364 wounded, 109 Marines are going to be killed, and another 69 wounded. And you also have about 68 civilians killed. And a lot of them are going to be killed from friendly fire. So as the United States starts returning fire to the aircraft, a lot of those shells start landing in, like,
yeah.
Honolulu and other places, yeah. And killing civilians. U.S. fleet's in shambles. Four battleships are going to be sunk. Other four are going to be heavily damaged. Nine other ships are damaged. We'll lose 188 aircraft, and with another 159 being damaged. The training ship, the Utah, was hit by two torpedoes and would capsize, killing 64 people on board. The ship is still in the harbor today. Most people don't actually go and see it because it's on the other side of the Arizona.
Yeah.
The Maryland's going to be hit by two bombs. She's only going to be slightly damaged, though, and be the first ship to return to service in 1942. So what you're going to see is the ships that battleship row, you had seven battleships basically anchored side by side, two by two. The ships that were on the outside are the ones that are going to take the most of the damage because torpedoes could hit them, where the ships that were between the other ship and Ford Island,
yeah.
they just took bomb damage.
So I know I asked about the you're talking about the aircraft carriers that were supposed to be there?
Yes.
Of the four that we had, you know, the Lexington was at Midway. For troops, Enterprise was at Wake Island.
Okay.
Saratoga was at San Diego on December 7th, and then the Yorktown was in the Atlantic Fleet, and they had just called them the Pacific.
Okay.
So they were, you know, Panama Canal area. So
we were lucky.
That's
the Pennsylvania was actually the only battleship not on battleship row because it was in dry dock getting repaired. The ship was hit by one bomb and debris from a nearby destroyer. It would be repaired and back in service by March of 42. Tennessee was hit by two bombs, returned to service, and retured by February 1941. California is going to be hit by two bombs and torpedoes and sunk, but the California is eventually going to be risen and repaired and re-enter service as well. So one thing about Pearl Harbor is, since the harbor is so shallow, even if the boats sank, they rested on. They didn't completely sink or submerge.
It's not like it's at the bottom of this extreme ocean here. Like, you can still get them out.
Yeah, because even if they sunk and were resting on the floor of the harbor, you still had like the top two.
You had enough to
levels
get
of
out.
The ship actually above surface. So what they would do is they would figure out where the holes were, they would patch them up underwater welders, and then they'd start pumping the water out.
Right.
And then eventually buoyancy would come back.
Sense.
Tennessee was hit by two bombs, returned to service, and returned by February 1941, so that's pretty quick. California was hit by two bombs, torpedoes, and sunk. Did I already say those two?
Yes.
I might need that then. All right. USS Nevada was the only battleship that came under power. Nevada was not moored next to any other ship, so it was able to maneuver out of its mooring. She tried to get out of the harbor, but as she was making her escape, she would be hit by six bombs and torpedoes. Nevada began to take on more and more damage and began taking in water. So the captain is purposely going to beach the battleship and run it ashore so it doesn't block the channel. Because if Nevada blocks, sinks in the channel, because there's only one way in, one way out,
you've
it's
now,
pretty narrow.
You've now effectively just blocked the harbor.
Yes. Now nothing can get in, nothing can get out until you get Nevada out of there, which will take months. So
that's really strategic move.
Correct.
By this captain.
I believe he gets the Medal of Honor.
And not only that, but you almost save your ship, too, because you can now, I mean, it's, I say it's easier to fix a ship. I mean, you have to move it off the land now, but that's, you know, easier than effectively having to pull it up from the ocean.
Yes.
So.
The Nevada would sink but be salvaged and act as the flagship during the D-Day invasions. USS West Virginia was sunk. Was hit by 6 torpedoes and 2 bombs. The ship would then catch on fire after being surrounded by burning oil from other ships. The captain, Mervyn Benyon, was mortally wounded but received the Medal of Honor for staying on the ship and assisting with defenses. He took a shrapnel and basically sliced his abdomen wide open.
Yikes.
Another individual on the ship that a lot of people know about, his name is Dory Miller. He was an African-American cook aboard the West Virginia. He's on the bridge actually helping Benyon when he died. Miller would then go man a machine gun, even though he was not trained to operate one. And he's going to be credited with shooting down 2 aircraft, even though he's never been trained on how to use a machine gun. I believe our newest aircraft carrier is going to be named after him.
The
Dory Miller.
Nice.
Yes. West Virginia would also be repaired and serve again in the war. So what you're seeing is, even though they've done damage to our battleships, most of them are returning to service.
Yeah.
The other thing is, most of the battleships that were there are obsolete.
Right.
They're old. They're from World War I. Like, we've built 4 new battleships since World War I, and they're over in the Atlantic.
Okay. Right. So, I mean,
and the problem with the World War I era battleships are they're slow, so they can't keep up with aircraft carriers, and they use a lot of fuel. So even though these ships are going to be reused again, they're in terms of naval combat, they're basically just used for shore bombardment because they're too slow to keep up with a normal fleet.
So in the USS Doris Miller, the next in the line of the drill are Ford class aircraft carriers in the U.S. Navy. It's scheduled to be laid down in January of 2026, launched October of 2029, and then commissioned in 2032. So it should be here.
That's insane. It takes them 3 years to build a boat. That's how big they are. That's insane.
It's a huge boat.
Yeah.
And it's going to be huge.
All right, so USS Oklahoma port was hit by 8 torpedoes at the very start of the attack. Within 12 minutes, she capsized, her mast touched to the bottom. It happened so fast that a lot of the men are going to be trapped inside. 32 of them are going to be rescued. This is kind of a really sad story. So the ship capsized, but they couldn't, first off, because of all the flames and fire, they couldn't, the metal was so hot, they couldn't,
touch it.
They were actually on there like within minutes trying to get these guys out. And the way it would work is the keel of a ship is relatively thin,
right?
Just to reduce weight, and you don't really need a lot of armor there because it's the underside of a ship. Like,
so you would blow
so
it.
What they would do is they'd have welders come in and try to cut a hole in the keel and then get in the other compartments of the ship. The problem is you had to be very careful because by doing that, it changed the air pressure within the ship and it could cause the water to move as well.
Gotcha.
So what happened was for about 2 weeks, they could hear guys tapping like SOS on the keel, like where they were stuck, but they couldn't get to them in time. And then eventually they just ran out of oxygen.
Gotcha.
Really sad story. Oklahoma is going to be salvaged, but not used again during the remainder of the war. So the USS Arizona, probably the most famous of the battleships, was hit multiple times in the first few minutes of the attack. One of the armor-piercing bombs penetrated the deck and detonated near the ship's forward magazine. So that's where they keep all of their gunpowder, all their ammunition for their big guns. I believe there were 14-inch guns at that time. The explosion was massive. And when I went to Pearl Harbor, I don't know if this is true or not, the guy told us that was the largest man-made explosion up until the atomic bomb was dropped.
That's got to be huge.
Yes. He even said that the ship itself raised out of the water by about 6 feet.
And 6 feet?
And the anchor was thrown like 40 feet in the air.
Oh my
That's gosh. What he said. Now, I've never been able to confirm it, but that's what the guide said.
That's a
it's
lot
still
of,
a massive explosion.
That's a lot of force, too, to move a ship that big out of the water.
A massive fracture occurred in the forward section of the ship, and the ship immediately sank. Those inside of the ship were, for the most part, instantly killed just from the percussion of the explosion, just from it ripping through the ship. There were guys on top of the ship that were thrown overboard. Of the 1,512 men aboard, 1,177 were killed. Once again, most of them didn't even know they were under attack. It was just done. There was a possible third wave. Japanese Admiral Nagumo was urged by officers to launch a third attack to target fuel, torpedo storage, maintenance, and dry docks. They argued this would hinder the ability to repair ships. Also, if the oil tanks were hit, Pearl Harbor would be out of action for a very long time. Admiral Nimitz of the United States even said it would have probably prolonged the war by 1 or 2 years. So pretty much the U.S. Navy, if they would have successfully launched this third wave, U.S. Navy probably would have been out of action for at least a year.
Yeah.
Because there would be nothing left in Pearl Harbor to repair all the ships that were destroyed and things like that. So Nagumo, though, is going to call off the attack for several reasons. By the end of the second attack, U.S. defenses were responding with more force, and the Japanese began taking losses. He also still did not know where the U.S. carriers were. And he was afraid that if the carriers show up, they're going to be able to attack our fleet. Also, his planes would have to land at night, and no one had really done that yet. So he's like, yeah, we're not. And also, Nagumo was very cautious to begin with. And this has become one of the great what-ifs in military history. What if the Japanese had actually launched that third attack? So, as the attack was happening, Japanese also attacked Malaya, Singapore, and Hong Kong in the Philippines. As news reports started to come out, panic started to strike the American public. Paranoia of an imminent attack on the U.S. mainland persisted for a while. There's even the famed Battle for Los Angeles, where like there was a guy flying a plane over L.A., and everybody thought it was a Japanese bomber, and they just started shooting at him.
But, you know, that's another thing, though, that, like, whenever, like, that's something that, you know, comes out of, Pearl Harbor is, it's fairly close to California.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Hawaii is not that far from California, in terms of, you know, during this war, when people get close, not only is, you know, it's not just military, but it's also now public opinion is what's going to happen next.
Yes.
Are they coming for us? Is it... Is this the start of us, and, you know, falling? Like, what's happening?
And you also got to realize this is way before social media and things like that. Like, people just don't know what's going on.
Right.
Like, even as reports of the attack are coming through, people still have no clue what's going on or things like that. There's one story I remember hearing that, so it's Sunday. It's like 1 o'clock on a Sunday, like East Coast time, and there's an NFL game going on in Washington.
Yeah,
and people start realizing that something has probably happened when they start hearing the PA announcer calling for all these high-ranking officials in the U.S. government and military to report to
the Capitol.
Yeah, report to places extremely fast, and that's when people were like, "What's going on?" But yeah, I mean, even after the attack,
yeah.
Like,
I mean, there's
people just don't know because
it's such a
news
different,
do not travel.
I mean, it's such a different age now. You're talking about like with social media. We have the ability now, like, we can find out information in a matter of seconds.
People can report it instantly.
And people can
yeah.
share information super fast.
Yeah.
But, I mean, their main form of communication, like, the way they would broadcast that mainly is, you know, word of mouth or radio.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's it. They
yeah.
don't have.
So the day after the attack, FDR would deliver his famous Day of Infamy speech asking Congress for declaration of war. Less than an hour later, Congress formally declared war on Japan. UK had actually declared war on Japan by about 9 hours before the U.S. And then like a day later, I think Germany declares war on the United States. The Allies had no ships left in Pacific, and the Japanese Navy would have free reign. Strategically, the Japanese had achieved victory at Pearl Harbor, but it was not as large as they had hoped. Only two of the battleships were destroyed, and the aircraft carriers would go untouched. Admiral Tadayoshi would say, "We won a great tactical victory at Pearl Harbor and thereby lost the war." Yamamoto, supposedly, now this is a big supposedly, what is Yamamoto's famous quote about Pearl Harbor? Do you know?
No.
Everybody quotes him as saying this. "I fear all we have done is awaken
oh,
a
yeah,
sleeping
giant
and fill him with terrible resolve." Reality is, there was a movie in the 70s called Tora 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 about
right.
Pearl
I've
Harbor.
Heard it.
And the writer of the movie made it up. There's no like real evidence that Yamamoto said ever said that. The guy that wrote it was said like, oh, I have a letter directly from Yamamoto saying like with those words in it. But when that people asked him like to produce the letter, he's like, oh, I lost it, and things like that. But on the other hand, Yamamoto did have that sentiment. He was one of the Japanese military officials that had trained in the United States, had gone to school in the United States, and he knew pretty well. They said actually Yamamoto, he was walking around like depressed for like a couple days after the attack for two reasons. One, because he knew that basically Japan was about to get
It was about to go down.
It was, yeah, and it was going to be bad. Two, he felt he was very upset at the fact that it was a surprise attack and that that declaration didn't come out before.
Yeah, because you know the Japanese culture, like you see it in wartime, but you know it's all about honor. It's all about, you know, honoring codes of war and things like that. To do a surprise attack to them is something that is really unheard of because it's not honorable to their culture. It's not honorable to do attack.
So you had a lot of people in the Japanese military celebrating this great victory, but you also had a lot of people saying, like, basically along the lines, like, is it really good to be celebrating when you sucker punch somebody?
Yeah.
Like, you just don't walk up to somebody, punch them in the face, and then stand over them and cheer after you knock, like, cold-cocked them and they're laying on the ground.
That's
just going to anger them. So the attack on Pearl Harbor would drag the U.S. into a brutal war that would see the death of around 111,606 Americans in the Pacific and over 2 million Japanese. If you go to Pearl Harbor today, you can still see traces of the battle that took place there. On one side of Ford Island, you have the lesser-known wreckage of the USS Utah, which I think they just put up a memorial a couple years ago, too. At Ford Island itself, you can still see the pockmarks in the runway from where it was strafed by Japanese Zeros. And then on the other side, you have the USS Arizona Memorial. Memorial is built over the actual wreckage of the Arizona. The ship is still leaking oil, which veterans say it's the ship bleeding or crying. And basically, it is considered to be a national cemetery. And if you had served on the USS Arizona during the time of the attack, you are allowed to be cremated and your remains put inside the ship.
Hmm.
A couple guys had done that over the last couple years. And if you look at the memorial, it's kind of like a inverted arch.
Right.
It's supposed to represent, so the high point on the left side is supposed to like represent like before the war, the dip is Pearl Harbor, and then as it rises up, it's U.S. resolve and victory. And then also, if you go to U.S. Arizona, you look straight ahead, you can see the USS Missouri, which is the battleship where the Japanese surrendered. So you literally have the beginning and the end of the war facing each other. USS Arizona, they are fearful that it's deteriorating and that it might collapse upon itself. And the U.S. Park Service actually goes in there and kind of checks things out to make sure that's stable. They sent a submersive in there, and they actually were happy with what they found. They were sad and happy. They were finally able to get down into the third level of the ship because submersives have gotten small enough for them to go in there. When they went in there, they got into an officer's quarters, and when they were looking in there, the officer's suit was still hanging on a coat hanger, firmly pressed, hat on bunk. But what made them happy about finding that is it showed them that there's no oxygen in that part of the ship, so therefore it's not going to deteriorate as fast.
Gotcha.
The more you know. Thank you, PBS, for that documentary.
Sounds like a really interesting documentary.
It was good. I enjoyed it. So thank you for listening to Pearl Harbor. Join us next week as we talk about Christmas toys.
Thank you for tuning in to History Class After Hours, the show where we talk about the things your history teachers didn't have time to teach you. If you wanted to stay updated on upcoming events for the History Club, please visit www.starsmillhistoryc.wixsite.com/2020. If you liked this episode, please share it with your friends and subscribe to our channel on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. Be on the lookout for new episodes, and we'll be posting every week. Until next time, stay curious.